Blog Talk Radio.
LifeQuest Christian Network.
Welcome to Reflecting His Gift. I'm Susie Ellison, your host, and I believe that everyone has a God-given purpose, a gift or a talent, a testimony of grace that is meant to impact this world for the good and bring glory and honor to God. I also believe, as Romans 8:28 tells us, that all things, even the bad stuff, work together for the good of those who've been called according to God's purposes. God is famous for making lemonade out of lemons, giving hope to the hopeless, using the foolish to confound the wise, and even using our worst pain and losses to make us stronger, teach us important lessons, and then to use us as beacons of light as we comfort others who may encounter the same trials. Tonight our program is about a subject near and dear to my heart, post-traumatic stress disorder, an incredible and amazing therapy available for those who struggle with this disorder. 18 years ago, I had never heard of trauma therapy. I really didn't even know what emotional trauma was, although I was certainly a traumatized individual. 25 years of addiction to drugs and alcohol came to a screeching halt as God mercifully allowed the drastic in my own life to accomplish the drastic deliverance that I so needed. My whole life came crashing down around me, and with it, my emotions and my mind. I suffered a complete breakdown resulting from years of what I call trap trauma, which I had continually tried to medicate with drugs and alcohol. I went through the most horrific non-medically supervised drug withdrawal from many kinds of very addictive substances, and it lasted a nightmarish 7 days. And as I went through the drug withdrawal, abandoned and by myself in an old crumbling house, I went through a traumatic, nightmarish, continual 7-day terrifying flashback of all the pain I'd ever endured in my lifetime. At the end of it all, I was hospitalized and diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I found myself in a trauma therapy group and received EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy. As a result, combined with my newfound and powerful faith in God, the therapy gently catapulted me into a new and incredible journey of freedom. I was completely delivered and healed of drug addiction, and for 18 years I've remained totally drug and alcohol free. I will always believe with all my heart that not only my faith in the Lord, but the powerful and amazing emotional release I experienced with trauma therapy changed me forever, revealing and then healing some dark and buried places in my mind and soul that had been screaming out to be released and comforted. I believe there are more stories of what I call trap trauma and silent screams than we could ever imagine, each one crying out to be heard, continually, adversely, affecting the minds and hearts of people who are trapped in self-destructive behaviors as a result of their trap trauma. My guest this evening is Phil Harris. Phil is a certified trauma counselor, and he helps people with trap trauma to find that same kind of amazing release and recovery. Phil has been through some things in his own life that have led him to this very important and valuable profession and his desire to help those who suffer with traumatic episodes. He's going to share some of his own life story with us tonight, and he will also tell us about his work as a trauma therapist. It's my pleasure to welcome Phil Harris to Reflecting His Gifts. Hi, Phil.
Hello, Sissy. Good evening.
Good evening. Phil, I love to paint an up-close and personal picture of the lives of my guests for our listeners, and I like to start with childhood. Would you tell us who Phil Harris is, where you grew up, and what was your world like when you were young?
I'd love to. Phil Harris is a white middle-class American who grew up shortly after World War II in Chicago, Illinois. I grew up on the north side of Chicago, about 3 blocks from Wrigley Field, baseball field on Addison Avenue. And that's pretty much where I spent the first 10 years of my childhood, city of Chicago. And it was, in those days, in the early 50s, it was quite a bit different than now.
It wasn't it? It was a whole different world. I kind of long for that world, don't you?
Yeah, things were simpler and seemed a lot more recognizable, at least maybe not so complex.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I think there was more patience in our world, too, because I think technology has kind of messed up patience, don't you? Children knew how to play, really play.
Exactly. We did play, and I remember as a child, I grew up with two brothers, very close in age to myself. We had our own little gang, the Harris Boys, and you know, we just enjoyed simple things like playing out in the parks and a nice day and other kids and, gosh, I don't know, riding bikes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Cool stuff.
Yes, it was. Well, Phil, was your family religious? Did you attend church with your family?
You know, my family, my dad is Irish-American, and my mom was a Mexican-French-American lady, and religion wasn't emphasized. You'd think possibly there would be Catholicism in our background.
Yes,
but my parents weren't practicing religion as such, and we went to a variety of churches. I remember as a little kid, mom taking us to various Sunday schools, Catholic and Lutheran and Methodist.
Yeah.
Just whatever was convenient at the time. And there were a lot of churches in Chicago.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned to me that alcoholism ran in your family. Were either of your parents alcoholics, and what was that like?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, my dad was Irish. Philip Sheridan Harris III. I'm Philip Sheridan Harris IV. And you can see in my family lineage, down through the generations, that alcoholism ran rampant through grandfathers, great-grandfathers, brothers, aunts, uncles.
Wow.
And I caught the magic bullet.
Yes.
And I didn't know at the time, but I did later on after I got into recovery and started studying addiction, that this is a majorly inheritable disorder.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. A lot of people don't believe that. They think it's a sin. And after all, you know, it is actually when you begin to consume large amounts of alcohol and get drunk and all those things. But do you believe that alcoholism and the propensity toward addiction can be inherited?
Oh, I absolutely believe that. When I first got into the field about 14 years ago, there was a debate raging in psychology, nature versus nurture. Was this disorder something about what was going on inside of me, or was it about something that happened externally in my world that caused it? And the debate's over, Sissy. The research is in. It looks like there's a genetic causality to this disorder. The National Addiction Centers have defined it as a primary disorder. About 40 to 60% can be pegged to family history and inheritance.
Yeah. Well, when a person struggles with alcoholism, does it affect them in a way that is different from people who can just take a social drink? I think in my life, I couldn't take just a social drink. It would just absolutely turn into a nightmarish experience that lasted, you know, 2 or 3 days. It wasn't one. It was, you know, on and on and on. And is that
right,
part of the disease that the alcoholic just cannot stop?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said. In recovery, there's an old saying, one drink's too many and 1,000's not enough.
Absolutely.
For the alcoholic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in this disorder, it's a three-part disorder. There's the actual allergy of the body that you inherit, where people with this inheritance can't metabolize this molecule correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also coupled with two other factors, two other components, an obsession of the mind, a peculiar mental twist that people without the disorder don't have, and a third majorly important component, and that is the spiritual disconnection from God.
Absolutely.
I believe.
I believe that, too. I so believe that. Well, you said you were in college during the 70s, and so was I, Phil, and I believe that was the era during which many addictions to alcohol and drugs began for many teens and young adults. Drugs and alcohol flowed more freely than ever before, and as they did, people became shackled to severe and long addictions. Was this true in your life? I know it was in mine.
Absolutely. That is one of the pieces of my truth. I'm a little slow learner. I didn't take my first drink till I was 17 years old, till after I graduated from high school in northern Illinois. I remember I went downstate to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, and that first semester at 17, in 1966, a couple of my friends in the dormitory said, "Whoa, we're going to go to a concert, see this band from California called The Doors, and you're really going to enjoy this because we're going to do something different." And I said, "What's that?" "Well, we're going to have a beer and we're going to smoke a joint." I went, "What's that?" And, you know, that night I smoked my first joint and drank my first beer, and something happened. You know, it altered my consciousness, and darn if I didn't chase that experience for the next 30 years.
Oh, man. Well, I was going to say, where did those flings leave you? What was going on during those years of substance abuse? I bet they're a blur. Mine are like that, just a blur. I mean, it's like a hurricane that I look back on.
Absolutely, a whirling tornado. Yeah. You know, I don't remember a lot of the 70s and 80s,
yes.
Just the high points. There was probably... it looks like about the age of 19 or 20, my substance use really became a dependency and addiction. And at that point, I got to the jumping off point you mentioned, where really I couldn't safely predict when I started using, if I was going to stop, at what point and how much. And that went on for quite a while.
Wow. Well, I mean, were you just dysfunctional? Were you able to work? Did you have a family? How did it affect your finances? I mean, you know, it takes so much from us. What did it take from you? What was your life like?
Well, actually, you know, early on in addiction, it's a progressive disorder, and it goes in stages. You know, at the very beginning, it's fun. It's sort of a medication. It soothes us, and it works for emotional pain and physical pain and everything else. And it's a hoot. But then later on, it's sort of fun, but there's complications. Mm-hmm. My life isn't working so well until at the end, you know, it doesn't work anymore, and it's a cataclysm. You know, I was going to college in the 70s, and I made it through 2 years of good college before my obsessive pursuit of substance at the highest level forced me out of an appointment to Annapolis and college in general.
Yeah, oh, wow.
I just couldn't maintain my focus and my precision at that point when drugs became more important and alcohol than other things that I'd learned as valuable as a youth.
Well, why is it, you know, they talk about chasing that high for the rest of your life. And why is it, will you explain to our listeners about the tolerance that is built up and why it doesn't feel the same and why you feel so bad after the experiences and how does addiction occur and why aren't people able to obtain that first time? Why do they have to increase and increase and increase the amount of the substances they use?
That's a good question, and it's got a few levels to it.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at some figures from SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, the other day from last year, and what they said was, 52% of all Americans above 12 had a drink last year.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of Americans, 135 million Americans.
Yeah.
Now, out of that 135 million Americans, about 90% can safely use this substance. Take a drink or two and go, that's fine for me. No more, thanks. It's don't need it. About 10% of us develop this disorder. And if you are among the lucky 10%, that choice to use or not use really is taken away from you by the, as you said, the dependence. Once we start using these chemicals, they actually build, the brain adapts to it. They build pathways and receptors in the brain, and when reintroduced, it activates this pleasure center, and it's impossible to predict when the obsession will stop with that 10% of us that have this.
Well, with those pathways that are formed in our brain and in our nervous system, that actually creates responses in our body to those pathways. Say, our body won't wake up anymore unless it has that stimulant we're addicted to, or we can't go to sleep or relax or be calm without the sedative or the weed or the drink. And so it's like the body falls into line with what those pathways are in the brain. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're right on the money there. Over time, as we mature through our lifespan, the disease also progressively gets stronger. And as we use more and more of these substances, the body becomes able to tolerate more and more and actually demand more to get the same equivalent feeling of relief or satisfaction or self-soothing that originally I might have got with one or two drinks. Now it takes a whole jug, a whole bottle. What
right,
I could get
right.
high on one or two joints, now I need to smoke a bunch or do
right.
a bunch of Oxycontin or a bunch of heroin.
Yeah.
It just never gets less. It's always more.
Exactly. It's like the body becomes a slave to those pathways you have created in your nervous system and in your brain.
Well said. It is slavery at the deepest level, molecular level.
Yeah. And then you begin to have to find ways to feed it. It's kind of like in that little shop of horrors. I remember that that big plant that started growing. And
feed
it
me.
Was so sweet at first. It was so sweet at first. It was just a sweet little plant, and then it grew into this monster that was screaming, feed me.
Absolutely.
And poor Seymour had to go around doing all kinds of horrible things to feed that, and I kind of think that's a correct description of that monster that we build inside ourselves when we are addicted to drugs and alcohol.
Yeah, that is a pretty good picture you painted right there. In the literature from Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson calls alcoholism the rapacious creditor that
mm-hmm.
only takes. That's a pretty picture.
Wow.
Rapacious, and the disorder does take it. It infiltrates all the domains of our life:
mm-hmm.
mind, body, spirit, mental, physical, spiritual, cognitive. And then, of course, as you said, behavior starts following that. As thinking and emotions and spirit get eroded, behavior gets eroded. And so people start doing some really not nice things in pursuit of this, what is almost an essential item in their lives. These substances supplant natural drive states like food, eating, sex, air.
Yes. Well, you know, and it's very sad because when these things begin to happen to an addict or an alcoholic, they don't just affect them, do they? It affects everybody in their circle. It's like when you throw a pebble out on the lake and you see those little ripples, that ripple effect. That's what begins to happen. In addiction, it affects the family, it affects the workplace, it affects the community, it affects so many things, doesn't it? And people think it's just their addiction, but it really isn't, is it, Bill?
Not at all, not at all. Your son or your daughter or your husband or wife may be the identified sick person, quotation marks. But it really is a family disorder, and it does resonate throughout the addict or alcoholic's life, first with family and then with close associates and colleagues and then the community and then the world.
Right.
Absolutely, this is a pervasive disorder. It costs our government hundreds of billions of dollars a year to address all the issues that are, you know, somewhat eroded and changed by addiction.
Right.
It is a huge problem.
Well, you know what? I feel like the biggest war that we have is the war with alcohol and drugs, and that is one that we should make a priority, because I think if you got rid of those addictions and those problems that they cause, the crime rate and the divorce rate, the motherless and fatherless children who are having to be taken care of, all those things would be cut in half or even more. I really believe that.
I have to agree that once you take substance abuse out of the equation, people
mm-hmm.
restore themselves. I mean, most people are really worthy and worthwhile. God doesn't
mm-hmm.
make garbage. He just doesn't.
Yeah.
But we do get way off course in our
yes.
behaviors under the influence and impairment of these substances. Take that away and people get restored to a lot of the good character assets and traits they have.
Absolutely. I believe that with all my heart. Well, Phil, you said that in 2001 you suffered a physical calamity and a near-death experience. What happened to you, Phil?
In 2001, just prior to that, during 2000, before 9/11, my little brother, Robert Wade, died from acute alcoholism. Not very pretty. And at that time, I had no clue as to how to cope with that tremendous, devastating tragedy in my life. So I drank and used more,
mm-hmm.
Which forced me to a physical, crisis of my own. I ended up in the intensive care unit of a hospital strapped down because my liver had shut down and the ammonia that is metabolized in our body wasn't being filtered out, and it was poisoning my brain. It was incredibly terrifying hallucinations.
Mm-mm-mm.
And fortunately, the medical community managed to save my life in the 11th hour.
I'm so thankful for that.
I am,
well,
too.
You know what?
I am, too. It made an impression on this hard-headed Irishman.
I bet. I don't believe that God causes bad things to happen to us.
No.
I believe we are careening toward those bad things through choices we make. But I do believe that God allows some things. And as I said, He allowed the drastic and unthinkable in my own life to accomplish a drastic and glorious salvation experience and restoration. Do you believe this too when you think about what happened to you? How did this change you and your faith and your life choices after?
I'm totally convinced that it had to be the hand of God. At this point, I see working in my life that
mm-hmm.
at the point when I was at my lowest, near death, I was saved by some amazing medical people, and they basically told me, look, if you're not willing to look at this addiction right now, you know, lose our numbers. We've worked way too hard to help people heal. If you won't help heal yourself, we don't have time for you. And that really shocked me. I mean, don't they know who I am? You know, it was amazing, and it terrified me. I thought, oh, my gosh, now what do I have to do? And at that time, I was going through some physical disruption in my leg as well, and
mm-hmm.
I really had no choice but to seek recovery because I was finally beat enough I was humbled enough to say, please help me. And
yeah.
Some wonderful people reached out to me and threw me the life preserver.
Wow. That is so wonderful, and I'm so thankful that happened for you. Well, Phil, I know that all of this brought you to the wonderful career that you're involved in today. What led you to go back to college, and what did you study? How did this impact you in your decision to become involved in trauma therapy and addiction counseling?
You know, it was again, it looks like the hand of God working, doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I was incapacitated with leg problems in my first few months of recovery after the hospital incident, and I couldn't pursue my previous trade, which was I was a union house painter. I had a painting contracting company in Key West, Florida, and I couldn't do that anymore, and really didn't have a clue, but it was suggested to me by some very nice people in recovery that, well, you know, you're not that dumb, Phil. Why don't you just try going back to school and learn something different? I said, oh, no, I can't do that. I've been away for 30 years. I'm way too old. These kids are too fast, too smart. I can't keep up. Well, I was wrong.
Yeah.
I went back to school and found I was fascinated and focused at being a sober man in recovery, and I had enthusiasm, which I applied to the study of my own disorder at first, like, how did I get here? So I started studying addiction and alcoholism and counseling early on.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You know, I went back to college myself in this whole saga called my life, and I had failed a lot of things. Not a lot of things. I was terrible in math and different things. And in college, I ended up with a 4-point. I ended up with a 4-point and the Outstanding Scholar Award in the field of human services. So
absolutely.
God just does what is that they do when they do it to cars? They rehaul? What is that word I'm trying to say?
It's an overhaul.
It's a
major redo and a detailing, yeah.
And he did that in you, and I think he did that in me, too.
Absolutely.
Well, Phil, we're going to pause for a few moments to hear a word from our sponsor about the wonderful and exciting Woods End series by gifted author Alexandra Clare. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
The Woods End series by Alexandra Clare. When Andrea is framed for murder, she discovers that divorce cannot sever the ties from a dangerous cult. Follow Boston Police Detective Jared Shield as he sets out to solve a murder and kidnapping, only to confront a vast conspiracy competing to produce the last Antichrist of world history. Against the backdrop of drama and intrigue, the Woods End characters come to see that demons are on their last assignments. Bible prophecy unfolds in real time, and Jesus Christ is at the door. Two books, Woods End, and the thrilling sequel, The Year Between the Woods. Download from Kindle, Nook, Screwpulp.com, or purchase the softcover at Amazon. Also by Alexandra Clare, a work of nonfiction, discerning spirits, visionary gifts, and practice. Find it all at alexandraclare.com.
LifeQuest Christian Network.
Welcome back to Reflecting His Gifts. We're talking tonight with Phil Harris from Florida. Phil is an addiction counselor and a trauma therapist. And Phil, you specialize in trauma therapy. And not many people understand the value and the need of trauma therapy. I didn't know what that was until I needed it myself and had it. For those who don't know or understand what trauma therapy is, would you share with us what PTSD is, what the causes are, and what treatments are used to help those who suffer with PTSD?
I'd love to. PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a collection of symptoms that evolve from what we call acute stress disorder, and that is when something really disturbing happens to a person, Mm-hmm. It leaves an impression, like, for example, like your hand slapping the sand. It leaves this indelible impression that is there for a while, and mind stores this. And if it comes into mind in a very distressful way, mind attaches distorted meaning to that event as it's stored, and it takes a lot of energy out of the system. And that is very deeply almost hardwired into our memory system. Mm-hmm. And this PTSD syndrome can be really distressful for people because, again, structurally similar occurrences that happen to us later in life will reactivate the symptoms that originally drove the person to seek some sort of relief, possibly through therapy, sometimes dysfunctionally through drugs and alcohol or other behaviors.
Right. Well, you've described exactly what happened to me, because there was early trauma in my life, but then at the end there was that 7-day experience and some domestic violence and different things, and they said the two episodes, or the childhood and the adult, were reverberating and vibrating and caused me to have the total collapse that I did. So that's just what you described, right?
Yes, absolutely. You're talking about two periods in our development as human beings that are really essentially important for the individual, one between the age of 2 and 4, and the other but about 15 to 17, the brain is very, has plasticity and is easily influenced. So if events occur during these periods, they're really hardly stamped into the memory system and make a big impact.
Exactly. And then what happens to all that if it isn't, if it isn't shared, expressed? I have a term that I've used, because I worked with women, prostitutes and homeless women on the street in a ministry that I planted, and so many of them had traumatic episodes in their lives, but they had never, ever, ever voiced it or received any kind of comfort or care for it. So what happens when it is trapped inside, Phil? You know, what does this do? Like, say, if a person endures molestation as a child, how could that experience affect their behavior as they mature? What happens to that trauma?
If that trauma isn't cleared, or in your case, it was reprocessed through EMDR, you know, that adaptive information processing that's so nice that EMDR sometimes accomplishes. If that doesn't occur, then, as you said, this particular experience and the emotion attached to it by mind will become stuck and frozen. This trapped trauma you referred to, nice expression. I look at it as a sort of a frozen, almost like if you tried to throw an avocado pit into your garbage disposal. You know, that wouldn't work very well. It would bang around in there, and it wouldn't go through. It gets stuck. And
or one of those bombs, what do they call those grenades that is lying in the mind?
Right.
The soul of a person is just sitting there waiting to explode. So finally it does, doesn't it?
It does. It does, and it can have some devastating effects on the person and also people that are closely associated and related to the person, because, you know, the system, the stress on the system is just unbearable until it's finally cleared. And, for example, you know, Iraq veteran hears a firecracker outside the window, dives under the coffee table. Well, you know, that's because it's structurally similar to that grenade he heard over in Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
But mine tells him it's still happening, and he's locked into that trap cycle.
Yes. Well, it's a really strange thing because, as I mentioned, I dealt with women that yeah. were involved in prostitution. Well, at the root of many of their lives was a story of sexual molestation. But strangely enough, what I found, and even in my own life, I would gravitate towards abusive people or mm-hmm. like a moth to a flame. It's like a person who has gone through some kind of traumatic episode like that. It's like they sometimes will gravitate toward those same experiences. And why is that? What is that phenomenon where they just absolutely keep going like a moth into a flame toward the very thing that hurt them and those kinds of people?
You know, that's well said. There are cycles of abuse, cycles of trauma, patterns, themes, trends mm-hmm. that get stamped into our consciousness very early on. And sometimes we seek these out later in life, not because we really want to, but they're familiar. We know this.
Exactly.
We
there
know
you go.
These. And like you said, women that are abused early, I worked in jail for a while. In our jail
yeah.
programs, probably
yeah.
80% of the women in the jail programs had been sexually abused, 40% mm-hmm. of the men.
Mm-hmm.
It is a national scale.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma-informed care is the standard of excellence. Now, you have to look at trauma.
Yes, yes. Well, it's the same thing. Like, would you say that people who exhibit violent behavior, domestic violence in their early childhood may be prone to inflict that kind of behavior on others, or they might have that same kind of temperament? Or why is that? Do we learn that behavior, or is it that bomb that's sitting inside? What causes that?
You know, it's you said a couple really good things there. A lot of times it's learned behavior. It passes down through the generations.
Mm-hmm.
And so if granddad abused grandma mm-hmm. and it was passed down to dad and dad learned that and found it to be acceptable in the family, he did that sometimes. And so we learn that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it can be like gas being poured on a fire that's already going.
Yes.
If there is some other disorder that is
yes.
primary going on, like possibly an inherited addiction or mental illness that's inherited. Propensity
mm-hmm.
for anxiety, conduct disorder, depression. This
yes.
can exacerbate the problem and make it much, much worse.
Yes,
and it
sure.
keeps repeating until the cycle's broken.
Yes, and that's what I was just fixing to say. The cycle has to be broken. And in
yes.
my life, my life choices and the way that I dealt with the problems that I had inside my heart and mind were affecting my family and my daughter. I always say it's like you have an infectious disease, and it's very rare for children who have parents with alcoholism and addiction to escape that same infection. And sadly enough, my own child began to exhibit that. So, you know, it's just like we just pass it on. But what happened in my family, Phil, was that I broke out of that. Thank God I broke out. I almost had to because he pushed me out of my situation and into help. I wouldn't have gone for it myself if my life hadn't crumbled like it did, much like yours. It was a very, very drastic occurrence in my life. But as I did that, and as I went for help and stayed, I ended up staying in rehab for 5 years, and then, like I said, going to college and all those things. Well, I was given the privilege of becoming the custodial parent for my grandson because his own parents were suffering with this kind of disease as well. Well, now he, with my new life and the seeds that I have planted in my lifestyle and my good character and my work on myself, he doesn't bear any resemblance to that old life that he had or that I had or that his mom and dad had. And he's like a totally different person. So, hello? Alex?
Okay, this is Alex Clare, and we've had a little bit of a glitch with our show tonight, and I'm just waiting at the moment for Sissy Ellison to call back in and for our guest to call back in, and I want to apologize. I really don't know what happened, but we all just kind of got shuffled off the switchboard here. But, Sissy, you are back on. Is that right?
I'm back. I'm back. And I just
okay.
talked to Phil, and he's trying to call back, too. So
okay.
He'll be
well,
back
it's
on
been
in a moment.
He'll be on, and it's been a great discussion. I've so enjoyed it.
Hasn't
and,
it?
Yeah. And you're in now the second half of the discussion, and you're going to talk more about trauma and the role that trauma plays in helping people overcome addiction and serious life issues that may be impacting them, including life-stealing behavior. Isn't that right?
That's right. And Phil has been describing his own experience in trauma and crisis, and it actually led him to this profession and this God-given purpose. He's just a wonderful person, and he was telling us about trauma therapy, which is a favorite subject of mine.
Okay, and you know you can go a little bit longer with him when he calls back
Thank
in if you,
you
need to. Yeah, because we do have an extra time scheduled.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I hope he
so
knows.
Here,
if,
well, I think that he's here, so hold on just a moment.
Beautiful.
And Phil?
Ellison.
Hey, Phil.
Kelly?
Huh?
No, I
yes.
think actually, is this Phil Harris?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
It is? Phil?
Yes.
Are you back on the air?
I don't think so, Sissy. I think that this is a gift, that this is a call-in, someone who's called into the show who may have a question for you and for, and I'm not going to try and screen this call, so I'll let you just go ahead and talk. Okay.
Well, here's Phil, too, so do you have a question, sir?
I saw her about 15 minutes ago.
I'm sorry, what did he say?
She said she hit her head.
Alex?
She was in the house, but I don't know where. Kelly?
I don't know. We've got someone on the line, Alex.
Yeah, I don't know who this is. I think that this person has called into a wrong number. Sir, if you have called 911, you have called into the wrong number, so I'm going to disconnect you and let you call again.
Tell it.
Okay, I have disconnected that person.
Okay, Phil, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, Alex, if that person calls back that number, I guess we need to try to get some help for them some way. I don't know what's going on. Excuse me. We're talking, I'm so sorry for the interruption. We had the program server go down for a few minutes, but we're talking with Phil Harris, and we were talking about how the cycle must be broken oftentimes, well, all the time, in these addictive life experiences. And, Phil, that happened in my life, and it began to affect everybody that I left behind me in my family. And as I was saying, I raised my own grandson, who bears no resemblance to the addiction and the different things that were in our life 18 years ago. And he's a wonderful young man. And so when people break the cycle, it not only has good effects on that individual, it affects everybody in their lives, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It is a renewal and a regeneration for the whole family.
Mm-hmm.
And when we can break through, make that breakthrough emotionally, physically, spiritually, I believe that it's almost a parallel to a rebirth. We're
yes.
different people than we were before, absolutely different. I can't remember too well the man I was almost 15 years ago. He has changed.
Yes, and I can't remember, I can't even imagine doing the things that I used to do to try to obtain the drugs and the relationships I was in and all those crazy things. And all these years that I've had my grandson and raised him, I got him when he was 5 and he's 19. He's about to be 20 next month and in college and just a wonderful kid. But it's just amazing how children absorb the environment. And the environment that he was in with me was peaceful. It was, we went to church. We had values and rules and boundaries in our home. And today, he is just so unlike what I was like as a teenager. Mm-hmm. He can manage money. He holds down a job while he goes to school. He pays his own bills. And I just look at him and think, my goodness, you know, that was breaking that cycle. All those good seeds and good habits are in that child. So it's a very wonderful thing when someone has the courage to break free and break that cycle.
It's miraculous.
Yes.
Miraculous. Well, and like you said, in addiction or in our disorder, whatever that might be, because
yeah.
My belief is we're all recovering from something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be substances, could be mental challenges, could be physical challenges, relational, whatever, mm-hmm. abuse. But when we make that shift, that transformation, we have a amazingly positive effect on the rest of the people around us. And that is the source of this, you know, the spirit of healing and
yes.
health that we actually take forward to other people.
Absolutely. The whole world can be affected by that. I mean, you know, I don't encounter many people that I don't share my story with or my faith or my hope. And
yes.
and when I see someone who is suffering like I was suffering, I'm so led to pray for them or to talk with them. And I know you are too, Phil.
Yes.
I had not heard of rapid resolution therapy until I heard of you. Could you explain to me and our listeners what rapid resolution therapy is, who Dr. John Connolly is, and how this therapy helps people with PTSD?
Dr. John Connolly is an amazing man. I met about 4 years ago, a little over 4 years ago. He's been a practitioner of, I think he's got a PhD in pastoral counseling. But he's been a practitioner of amazing psychotherapy for 30 years or more. And when I first met him and his breakthrough trainings, he taught us about how we could clear trauma painlessly, easily, and with lasting effects so that people can heal and restore themselves to, from, you know, impactful experiences that have been hindering them for 10, 15, 20 years.
Right.
And I was fascinated. I said, I have to find out how to do this. I want to do that.
Yes. Yes. Well, how do you do that? What is it?
It's an amazing set of processes that the doctors developed over years. It's a very solution-focused, very brief therapy. He doesn't believe in dragging out therapy or getting people through what they need to heal any longer than a handful of sessions, 1, 2, 3 sessions, and you get remarkable results. And it comes from just connecting with people and with purposeful communication and credibility. And through effective language, we can get the desired response we want from Carl Jung used to call it the subconscious. It's a deeper mind, a primitive part of mind that is very, very powerful and very responsive. This is where all the energy that energizes our emotions and our passions come from.
Yes.
And it understands symbols. That's why every country has a flag, every church has an icon, because mind really gets the symbolism and the power of this.
Yes.
And John teaches us how to unstick that, what you called stuck trauma, wrapped trauma, and clear it so it has no more attached meaning or dysfunction to it, and the person can actually be liberated from it. It's incredible.
Well, as I mentioned before, I received trauma therapy 18 years ago, and it was EMDR. What's the difference in EMDR and rapid resolution therapy?
You know, I've looked at them both. I'm not a certified practitioner of EMDR, though I have a lot of colleagues who have, and I've sat in on a variety of sessions, and it is a form of processing, moving information to a safe spot, a safe place, so that the patient can look at this without re-experiencing the traumatic event. And that is nice. It's sort of like another very good technique called neuro-linguistic programming,
right,
which also recodes information in a safe way. John Conley looked at all that and decided, you know, there's a way we can go one step farther. We can actually take that information that's stuck, data coming in that's being misread, and clear it so it has no more impact on the person, which is amazing. I can look at these traumatic events then like a dusty Civil War novel.
Exactly, exactly. It's like when those events are stuck, we described what it's like. I mean, it's like a bomb's inside. It's like a ticking bomb is inside, and they are begging to be released. And somehow or the other, these therapies can cause the person to be able to do what should have been done all those years ago or in those traumatic situations, to be able to process it, which for me it is that you would have caring, supportive people around you. You would have great comfort with you at a time like that. And, you know, all those things are in place, because when it was administered to me, it was just amazing. The release, the things that I recalled, the reaction I had, and there were things, Phil, I didn't even realize had troubled me so, so terribly. And once they were out there, I was able to think about them. Then I was able to actually talk about them, and then it was like they began to fade. Is that kind of describing the process?
It, you know, that really does describe it quite nicely. And there is an amazing sense of relief with my patients when they realize that this no longer has existence. No more needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
That they are finally free from what they've been carrying, this unfinished business, this baggage for years. That has coiled
like
up all the energy we need to heal, and has released it now for our healing.
It's like you have had a corpse that needed a burial, and you hadn't been able to bury it, and you hadn't been able to have the funeral until you went through this process. And I compare it to that. You can put those things to rest. That's just exactly what you just said. You put it to rest, and you can't until you go through this. Well, John, we hear a lot about soldiers that, I mean, Phil, we come, I'm so sorry, I called you John, because we were talking about John Conley, I guess.
Right.
But we hear a lot about war veterans who come home with PTSD, and you described, you know, how they might hear something and dive under the table. What is life like for a veteran who comes home with PTSD? Can you describe a little bit more of that? Because we hear so much of it nowadays.
It's amazingly poignant, because there are so many broken folks coming back from our wars, in service to us, for us, that are coming back having experienced things that human beings shouldn't experience.
Mm-hmm.
Without an adequate way to, again, relieve themselves of these impressions. The VA, God bless them, does the best they can, but their state-of-the-art therapy is a therapy called flooding, which re-traumatizes the patient, and it's terrifying. And a lot of these folks come back having learned skills, you know, war and death skills, come back and try to mainstream into our society, and it's pretty hard to fit into a nice, calm little society like ours. with all this stuff going through your head constantly.
Bless their heart, yes. I can only imagine. And it doesn't help to encounter people who just don't understand. It's the worst thing in the world, too.
Yeah, you can't just shake it off or pull yourself together. It takes some real precise and energetic work to relieve this. And fortunately, there are some good practitioners around that are able to do this. And one of my areas of interest is assisting veterans and assisting people that have come back from the service, you know, with wounds and brokenness that really nobody should have to live with.
Well, that is a very valuable way to use your skills, because if anyone ever needed that kind of help, they do. I have a friend who raises Labrador Retrievers, and they donate some of their beautiful puppies to an organization called Battle Buddies to be companions and service dogs to veterans suffering with PTSD. Are these pets a great source of comfort to their veterans, and why is it that a pet can bring such comfort to someone who can't really respond to a human being?
It's absolutely right, because a lot of folks that have been traumatized severely, either through war experience or even sexual trauma, mm-hmm. Have a very hard time trusting other human beings.
Yes.
So that when the unconditional love of a pet is introduced, it is like a life preserver being thrown. Because you don't get unconditional love very often,
right,
in life. You know, maybe from your pet, a small baby from God,
yeah.
And another one, and other people that have gone through maybe some of the same trenches as you have.
Right. And a baby and a dog or a cat or a pet and
right.
God are just about the only three trustworthy sources that a person who has lost trust in everyone can
yes.
still find some comfort, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Trust gets restored, but it does take time. And so that's a wonderful way to ease the person back into connection and association with something living that
right,
has
right.
meaning and love for them.
Right. That's so true. They need to love something, and something needs to be able to love them back so they can heal.
Correct.
Bill, how long must a patient receive rapid resolution therapy to see an improvement in their emotions and stability? You said it's very short term. Do the patients have to periodically go back for more of the same therapy, or is it just hopefully over with those two or three sessions?
You know, that depends on the patient. Usually when the trauma that's presented itself in the first session or two is cleared, there may not be any need to come back. However, mind will over time bring up to the patient other things that, you know, still persist in having some sort of emotional charge to it. At that time, that can be cleared as well. So it's hard to say, well, you know, it's going to take 18 sessions. You know,
yeah.
we really don't think in terms of that, or even a time duration on a session. It's let's get the job. What's on the table today? And let's make a real difference in your life today.
Yes.
So it could be just a very small handful of sessions.
Yeah, and since I have seen the drastic improvement in my life and the deliverance, really, I would just have to say I've been delivered.
Sure.
I haven't touched alcohol and drugs in 18 years. I mean, I've even had to have surgery, and I didn't have pain medication or anything. It's just like I'm the total opposite. But, you know, I just don't know how many people might be pausing or cautious about getting therapy. That's a real problem in our world, because you would go for cancer therapy, you would go for bronchitis, you would go for so many things, but so many attach a stigma to mental health issues and seeking help for those, when that could be the key that opens the door of healing for them. Don't you think there needs to be a better understanding and more, I don't know how to say it, what I'm trying to say. People need to not be so hesitant to reach out for healing in their emotions, because those get broken just like the body does, right?
Yeah, I agree totally. There is this stigma about, in our culture, admitting that, you know, in and of myself, I cannot heal myself.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do this. You know, I wrote a thesis in graduate school on John Wayne. In America, the American male has this cult of self-reliance where big boys don't cry and we don't let people see us hurt and we don't cry. And so that works in some aspects of life, but when we're trying to recover from trauma or addiction or anything, and I'm stopped from asking for help to reach out to another living human being, I'm in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right. It has more education and more reinforcement from support groups that, you can come, and we are here to help you. We have no agenda but to help you.
Absolutely, and it's like you can go for brain cancer, and that's no big deal, but if you have a brain weakness and an emotional weakness, you know, that's just not accepted. So that really needs to change, because
it's as valid a disorder, like you said, as cancer.
Yes.
It's valid a disorder, and it's a medically diagnosed disorder.
Yes. Well, Phil, I'm convinced that many chronic addicts who continually relapse may actually have buried traumatic episodes in their emotions, and that those hidden voices and moments from the past haunt them continually, causing self-destructive behavior such as anorexia, bulimia, depression, sexual promiscuity, suicidal tendencies, and addictions. Do you believe this as well, and do you believe trauma therapy should be available and offered more than it is in behavioral clinics and hospitals? And do you think it's often the tendency to offer medication to the patient who exhibits anxiety and depression as a result of trauma, when actually trauma therapy would be the better alternative?
I couldn't agree more. I'm not anti-medication, but I do find in our medicated society that a lot of well-meaning practitioners have a tendency to throw medication at symptoms and don't get to the root cause of what's presenting in the person, which needs to be addressed, possibly medication as an adjunct to good therapy and good support and a spiritual connection can be effective. Again, medications can mask these symptoms, and trauma is a fact of life. It's a well-hidden fact in our culture, but it is every family in America is touched by it.
Absolutely.
So it has to be addressed. We have to start getting honest about this.
Absolutely. Well, you shared with me, Phil, that you recently had some major health problems and had to undergo a leg amputation. Can you tell us how this has affected your faith and your outlook and your life?
Absolutely. 2 years ago, I had a choice to make. For the last 13 years, I've gone through a series of knee replacements. My knee went out right as I was getting sober in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And the blessing there was I came out of the operations clean and sober.
Mm-hmm.
And, however, I had artificial knees that just over time didn't work out for me. This last knee 2 years ago was finally being rejected by my body, created fluid. AMA couldn't stop the process. And I was given a choice where it would kill me or I could lose the leg.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like that choice much.
Mm-hmm.
So I prayed on it and decided it was, you know, it was clear it was time for change again.
Mm-hmm.
And the blessing is I'm ambulatory, and I have moved out of the problem, back in the solution in that domain too. No more knee pain, no more surgery, no more drugs and recovery.
Mm-hmm.
What a blessing.
What a blessing. And how do you use this experience? You sound like a person who uses absolutely everything you've been through to reach out to someone else. And I think you mentioned that you can even use this, or God has used this in your life and in other people's lives. How is that happening?
Absolutely. He's put people in my life now that have similar experiences as I do, and a lot of vets coming back from overseas are amputees from the disaster over there.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I have a whole new fellowship of people that I can be of service to, that I have, you know, similar experience, and they can connect with me in that way.
Yes.
You know, God's given me another avenue of connection. And it's amazing.
It's awesome how he does that. Our worst, our absolutely worst pain, our problems, if we can, I've always felt that the more you fight against something, the more it's going to hurt you. You're going to bruise yourself. You're going to become bitter inside. You're just going to become contaminated the more you fight adversity and loss and those things. But when you accept them and you become part of the solution in the world instead of part of the problem, it is amazing the doors that God opens and the people that he brings in front of you who benefit from your attitude and your faith and even your bad thing that happened to you. Don't you think that's true?
Absolutely. I'm a scientist, and I believe that if something exists, it was caused.
Yeah.
And in my life, what I've seen in the last 15 years, there were so many experiences and occurrences that happened that I can't explain scientifically. I finally had to get out of the debating society and just say, thank you, God. These are miraculous. It took
Absolutely.
Every experience I had to get me to this point today, Sissy.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been here with one less leg amputation, one less drink, one less drug, one less recovery. I needed all that. I needed to be tempered and be usable and of service to the Lord and to other people.
That is such an awesome attitude, and you're changing the world with that kind of attitude. That is just, I am just so inspired by you. Phil, how can a person know if they have PTSD? What are the symptoms? What should they do to obtain treatment? Where can they find out more about receiving this valuable form of therapy? Is it readily available in most cities, and does insurance cover trauma therapy? Just tell us how they know they might have this and what they need to do about it.
Okay, a lot of times you can, if you have emotions that persist in coming up and they don't seem to have an origin in the here and now, but they keep persisting to trouble you, chances are you were affected by something that happened at another time and mine still hasn't cleared it for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you're hyper alert, hyper vigilant,
mm-hmm.
Dissociative, so that you're out of your body a lot.
Mm-hmm.
If you're plagued by anxiety and depression,
mm-hmm.
possibly if you're compensating for all this emotional upheaval with drugs and alcohol and other obsessive behaviors, there could be and probably is something underneath all this behavior that's being driven by an event. So it would be good to go in and have somebody to talk to and
mm-hmm.
say, let's take a look and see what's there. What's
mm-hmm.
there for us to bring up, uncover, discover what about it's important or significant for you, and then discard it.
Mm-hmm.
Get that trapped trauma gone.
Yeah. Well, what do people look for? Like if they say, well, where do I begin to find a trauma therapist? You know, where would they look to find that?
In this day and age, you know, the Internet is so vital. If you go to www.cleartrauma.com
mm-hmm.
or www.rapidresolutiontherapy, You will find practitioners that do what I do all over the country.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful information. And I hope that people who are listening who recognize that they might be suffering with this PTSD, they will go to those websites. Is there anything that we can read about you or anything you would like to direct us to about yourself or anything, or Dr. Conley, or anything that people could go to find out more about things?
Those two websites, you can learn about John Conley, an amazing man, amazing healer. He's actually changed my life. He changed the way I look at my association with people and how I want to heal people. And it's been an inspiration for me that's changed the way I do my counseling. You can find me at philharriscounseling.com. And also, I just want to tell your listeners, Sissy, that don't despair. Folks, we do recover. We do recover. You know, I see now from this perspective, 15 years into my own recovery, that God brought me to recovery, and recovery brought me back to God.
Amen.
And it's available, and please, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. We're here to help. We're out here. And we love you, and we want you to heal.
You are so precious. Those are wonderful words. I'm just so inspired by you. I feel like I know you, and I just met you, and I just am so thankful for how you have used the pain of your past and how you've used your lessons that you have had to learn in that school of hard knocks, and how you've just used everything that has been dealt you to become the wonderful person you are today and the healer that you are, and what a blessing you are. Well, I've been so inspired by Phil Harris tonight. It's my hope that more people will become aware of the tremendous debilitating effect of trauma upon human emotions and lives. At the same time, it's my hope that those who have these very painful and traumatic episodes in their minds and hearts will seek help, turning to God and to those professionals who are able to administer trauma therapy and healing to their emotions. We've come to the close of another wonderful program tonight. I enjoyed this so much, and I know someone has been listening tonight who needed to hear everything Phil shared with us. Be sure and join us again next week for another inspiring guest who reflects God's gifts. Until then, may God keep you in his care. Good night, Phil, and thanks for being my guest this evening. God bless you, and good night, listeners.
Thank you so much, Sisney. Goodbye, listeners. Phil Harris loves you. Bye.
God bless you, Phil. Good night.